Wilmington was once called the freest town for a Negro in the country. That was a statement written in 1898, and back in the late 1800s, Wilmington was a mixed-race community that included blacks who held political office and political power. That all changed after the 1898 Wilmington Massacre. For generations, history told the story of brutal violence that was the result of a race riot initiated by blacks. We now know that this was a coup d'etat masterminded by white supremacists. Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and reporter David Zucchino dug in and dug through the archives. He used letters, diaries, and memoirs to paint a clearer picture of what really happened in Wilmington. His new book is Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. David Zucchino, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Good to be with you, Frank.
We should talk about this story because it's a surprising story, and it's one that still, even though there's been some publicity around this beginning in 2006 when the story was finally told, so few people know what happened in Wilmington in 1898.
Yeah, I'm amazed when I go around the country and around the state and mention what I'm working on, and I find very, very few people who have ever heard of this. And to me, that's remarkable. But this is an extraordinary chapter in our nation's history that really changed the course of history, not only in North Carolina, but across the South. This event inspired white supremacists across the South. What you had was basically, as you said, a coup. You had a band of committed white supremacists, some of the leading white citizens of the day, planning over a period of several months to overthrow a multiracial government in Wilmington, and at the same time to deprive blacks not only of the right to vote, but of the right to hold a public or elected office for probably the next 30, 40, 50, 60 years. It was an amazing achievement. They achieved the goals that they were after.
That they set out. The goals were explicit. There's plenty of documentation that shows these are precisely their goals, to suppress the black vote, to get control of Wilmington from the hands of this black-white coalition, and to maintain really a reign of terror, which was a term that they actually, I don't think reign of terror, but terror was a word that they used to frighten blacks. Talk about what exactly happened. Let's talk about what we know, whatever you call it, happened in 1898.
Yeah, as you mentioned earlier, there was a multiracial government. There were blacks in positions of power. There were city aldermen. There were black police officers. There were black magistrates, black postmasters. And this infuriated the white supremacists who had ruled North Carolina up before this, since Reconstruction. They decided early in 1898 that they were going to come up with a plan to overthrow the government and, as I said before, deprive blacks of the right to vote and hold office. And part of this included a newspaper propaganda campaign that was one of the most sophisticated run up until that time. They had two goals. It was to portray blacks first as incompetent, incapable of voting, incapable of holding public office, and completely corrupt. And at the same time, they portrayed blacks as sexually insatiable, on the prowl for white women, and they told whites in newspapers and in political cartoons that black men were coming for your women and they were coming for your jobs and they have to be eliminated. And one really interesting aspect of it was they realized that nearly a quarter of the population, of the white population of North Carolina, was illiterate. So Josephus Daniels, the publisher of the News and Observer in Raleigh, hired a political cartoonist to get these same points across with some incredibly racist cartoons depicting blacks as incompetent and sexually insatiable. There are several of the cartoons reprinted in the book.
Yeah, and to talk about a little bit more about that, the idea that these were, say, poorly educated white voters, or white citizens of North Carolina, who began to see more and more how much they had in common with the African-American citizens, the newly made citizens of the state of North Carolina, hence the fusion government in Wilmington, a majority black city, the most prosperous city in North Carolina in 1898, all kinds of industry, a majority black population, and a fusion government of blacks and whites. This meant that poor whites and blacks had finally seen what they had in common. This must die, according to the white supremacists.
This was unique across the South. There were very, very few examples of poor whites and recently freed, well, 30 years ago, recently freed blacks in a political union. The white populace had rebelled against the Democrats of the day, who were the white supremacists of the day, because they supported banks and railroad and big moneyed interests. And the whites felt that they weren't being representative, so they basically turned to the Republican Party, which had come into power in the South in large part due to the new class of blacks who were allowed to vote, and these black votes helped keep Republicans in office. So there was a bit of a political revolution in 1894 where fusionists took over the state legislature and also the city government in Wilmington. And as I said before, the white supremacists were not going to stand for this.
Yeah, and these were some of the leading citizens of North Carolina. You mentioned Josephus Daniels, the publisher of the Raleigh News and Observer. Charles Aycock figures heavily into this. Colonel Roger Moore. We should talk about some of these other figures, too. Talk about Charles Aycock, his role in this, and who he was.
Charles Aycock was one of the leading orators for the white supremacy campaign. And again, this went through the spring, summer, and fall of 1898, leading up to the elections in November. And he went out on the campaign trail and incited whites to violence against blacks. The white supremacists had their own private militia. They were called Red Shirts. They were an outgrowth of the KKK. Their job was to ride through black parts of town during the day and at night, terrorize blacks, warn them that they would be killed or beaten or worse if they registered to vote. On election day, the Red Shirts poured into Wilmington in November and beat and intimidated and kept blacks from voting. Charles Aycock, during his speeches, incited them to do this.
And this is the point that we're making here, is that these are, again, poor whites who had already seen that they had something in common. And so the way to drive the wedge is this fear that they are taking your jobs and your women and using cartoons and every form of propaganda, both rhetoric and in print, to break up this coalition.
Exactly. They had to turn these poor whites and uneducated whites and middle class whites, they had to turn them in blacks and against blacks. And as I described, that was the way they did it. You mentioned Josephus Daniels. He was the publisher of the News and Observer, which was by far the biggest and most important paper in the state. And newspapers at that time were king of media. There was no other media. And he was very skillful in planning fake stories in the News and Observer, accusing blacks of rape and incompetence and corruption with no facts behind it. In fact, in his memoirs years later, he admitted that he had gone too far and a lot of their stories were completely fabricated. But they had a very powerful effect on the white voters.
It already led to a rise in lynchings across the South, but it had not yet institutionalized the white terrorism, the state-sponsored terrorism that would become Jim Crow. It becomes institutionalized after the coup d'etat. Let's talk about what happened that day when the violence broke out and what led immediately to that violence.
One thing the white supremacists cited was an editorial in The Record, which was the black daily newspaper in Wilmington, which was published by Alex Manley. He had written an editorial in August saying that many black men lynched for rape were in fact consensual lovers of white women. And at the same time, he also pointed out that white men rape black women with impunity. And as you can imagine, this infuriated whites, not only in North Carolina, but across the South. And the red shirt militiamen wanted to lynch Alex Manley right away. And to show you how calculated this whole plot was, the leaders of the campaign said, no, now's not the time. We'll have greater political impact if we wait till closer to the election in November, many months away. And they did wait. And then 2 days after the election, the multiracial government was still in place because there were not city elections until the next year. So on that day, they had already made plans to burn the record and lynch Alex Manley. a mob of almost 2,000 white men, well-armed. They had been arming themselves over the summer. White merchants had purchased guns for use for white men who couldn't afford them. They marched on the record, burned the building. They did not find Alex Manley because he was warned about the lynch mob that had fled the city a few days earlier. And then they returned by streetcar on foot. Swarms of more white men came out to a corner in central Wilmington and confronted several black residents. And there was a verbal confrontation, which erupted into shooting. And from there on, white men just ran through the streets, shooting any black men they could find. They ended up killing at least 60 black men during that day.
And of course, this was, as we said, this was known as the Wilmington Race Riot. It was sold as an explosion of black anger that spilled out into the streets, led to violence. You have medical reports that I think that are fascinating. A number of African-Americans brought to the hospital who had been shot, and whites. And what was fascinating was that all of the black victims had been shot in the back, and that the whites had been shot in some part of the foreground, either their arm or chest.
Right. This newspaper propaganda campaign all summer had told whites that blacks were preparing a riot and were going to take over the city, and they were going to kill black men, women, and children. So this primed the white gunmen to more violence. And then once the spark was lit with this gunfire on this corner in Wilmington, it was out of control. And then the white supremacist leaders tried to keep it back under control, and they tried to bring it back, but they couldn't control the gunmen. At the same time, the whites also had their own state militias who were full of white supremacists. There was the Wilmington Light Infantry and the Naval Reserves. Both of these were state militias. They were the National Guard of the day. And they had served in the Spanish-American War, which had occurred that summer. And the white supremacist leaders made sure that these white militias who were full of white supremacists were back home in time for the day of the scheduled coup. At the same time, segregated black units who had also fought in the Spanish-American War were kept miles and miles away at a training camp in Georgia. So when this violence explodes, the whites are extremely well-armed. They have professional soldiers armed with two rapid-fire machine guns that had been purchased by white merchants, and they were unleashed on the black population that was robbed of their young black men who knew how to fight. They did not have very many guns because whites had made sure that blacks were not able to purchase guns, and this turned into not a race riot, but a massacre.
It was a massacre. Do we know, and there was also some concern because it is essentially the National Guard and to some extent connected with federal authority, some concern that their role be somewhat limited so as not to attract the attention of the federal authorities.
Yeah, there were two commanders of various units of these state militias, which were at the time federal militias, and the mob leaders made sure that they did not have a central role in this because they were worried if a federal soldier was seen to be directly involved in giving orders for federal soldiers to shoot black citizens, that the federal government would get involved. So their roles were downplayed, and they put other people in charge.
All right. So what about the aftermath? What do we know? We're still unclear how many people were killed and how many people were hurt in this event.
All we know is that there were at least 60 black men killed. Dozens and dozens were wounded. Another result of the violence was more than 2,000 blacks went out into, they fled their homes the day of the riot, went into the cemeteries and the swamps and hid in the cold for 2 or 3 days. And then, as I say, more than 2,000 fled the city in the aftermath of the riot. And a city that had been 56% black immediately became a white stronghold. And today, it's interesting, the black population of Wilmington is 18%.
Yeah.
There was an attempt, many attempts, to get the federal government to intervene. Black ministers went to Washington. Black politicians went to Washington and begged the administration to intervene. And from what I can find, President McKinley did not utter a single word after the riot, there was nothing done. No one was prosecuted. No one went to jail, certainly. This was a coup that was planned, carried out expertly, and no one was ever made to pay for it. No one was ever held to account.
Well, and to that point, I think taking a look at the way the national media of the time covered it, and let's talk a little bit, because you looked at the black press and the white press and the very different ways they covered this event.
This story was so well known nationwide that you had papers from across the country covering it, not just the day of the riot, but all summer. They called it the race war. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the Washington Star, papers from Atlanta, Philadelphia, Chicago, they all poured in to the city to watch the race riot that they had been told was going to be perpetrated by blacks. And when they arrived in town, they were met by the white supremacist leaders at the train station. They were given whiskey and cigars. Their lodging was arranged, and they basically embedded, to use a modern term, with all the gunmen who had been posted throughout the city, and their stories reflected the white narrative very closely. From what I can tell, they did not interview any black people. At the same time, the black paper obviously had been burned. Black newspapers across the country were afraid to send their reporters there because they were likely to be killed. But I was able to get the black perspective because black newspapers in the days after the riots, after the coup, were able to interview people who had fled Wilmington. So I got a very good picture of what it was like from the black point of view.
And what were they saying? I mean, I assume that they're telling the story, but what were some of the things you discovered?
These people were terrified, yeah. and they knew all summer that this was coming. They knew it from reading the newspaper and talking to their white neighbors. And even though I knew the outcome of this story as I was writing it, I just had this sense of dread the whole time of how inevitable this was. And I think the black people at that time must have felt that. They knew what was going to happen, and they felt so helpless. When it did happen, they said, "I'm done. I can't live here anymore," and they fled, and they never came back.
Well, you talked about the 2,000 who fled at gunpoint, essentially, but there was also some deliberate ethnic cleansing. Black leaders were taken out of town, sent out of town.
There was a very carefully orchestrated banishment campaign. They actually had a list of 50 black and white political leaders and influential people that they did not want in the city anymore. They literally rode them out of town on a rail. They marched them to the train station the day of the coup and the day after the coup, put them on trains and said, "Don't ever come back to Wilmington," and not one of them ever came back.
You know, it's amazing. You talked about McKinley not wanting to lift a finger or even say a word about this. This is probably one of the most un-American, apart from the Confederacy, which is an un-American act. You say you don't want to be American. That's un-American. But then to violently oppose meritocracy, to violently oppose democracy, to violently oppose citizens voting. There's nothing more un-American in American history, as I say, apart from secession. And yet the federal government did nothing.
Absolutely. And the really interesting part of this, that so much of it was built on violence and fear and intimidation. But after the coup, white supremacists had stolen the election by stuffing ballots and intimidating blacks. They took over the state legislature. The leaders of the coup passed legislation that was deliberately targeted at blacks to keep them from voting. They passed something called a grandfather clause, which exempted whites, because so many whites were illiterate, exempted whites from literacy tests and poll tax if their descendants had voted before 1867, which conveniently was the year that blacks got the vote. So obviously no blacks could qualify. And that basically kept blacks from voting in North Carolina from 1898 until after the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Yeah. If you can imagine, very, very few blacks voted during that entire period. So it was an amazingly successful coup.
And some of these things had already been in place. These voter suppression means had been in place, poll tax, literacy test. But it was North Carolinians who adopted, I think, the Louisiana grandfather clause,
correct.
Right? So, and said, "Oh, no, we're going to plug that loophole because we want our poor white voters to be able to vote."
That was the problem. The poor white voters were affected by the literacy tests. And in fact, Josephus Daniels made a trip to Louisiana to study just how effective the grandfather clause had been. And what's really interesting is he didn't want to pay for the trip, and he got the state Democratic Party to pay for it. He portrayed himself as a journalist. He was actually a politician who owned a newspaper. He was a member of the executive committee of the Democratic Party, and he actually held Democratic Party meetings in his newsroom. And as I say, his trip to Louisiana was portrayed as a journalistic exercise. Actually, it was a political propaganda effort, and of course, he persuaded whites that this was the way to go, and it passed in 1900.
So it's 1898 we're talking about. We talk about it because the history had not been told for more than 100 years. It is an extraordinary story, but it's not an old story. In fact, it is living with us today, probably in a bigger form than it was even then.
I think so. I mean, one example was, as I say, the white supremacy movement told white voters that blacks were rapists and they were coming for their jobs. Well, it really struck me when Donald Trump came down the escalator to announce his run for presidency and said that Mexicans were coming across the border, they were rapists, and they were coming to take American jobs. So this isn't just ancient history. This is today. This is right now.
And it remains effective. It still works.
It does. Yeah. Scapegoating, as you know, from the darkest corners of the internet and from Twitter, is a very effective political tool to demonize certain racial or ethnic groups, just as the white supremacists did in 1898. You have the rise of white nationalism or the alt-right today that uses some of those same tactics to play on fears and resentments of white voters against people of color.
Talk about the impact of this. We talked about the 1898 being a critical year in which state-sponsored terrorism, white supremacy, was institutionalized in the South, and how that differs from much of the violence that had preceded it. In fact, I want to use an example. We'll talk about an extraordinary man named Abraham Galloway, an escaped slave who was fought in the Union Army, but also led a black militia that drove out the KKK from Wilmington, right, in 1868. Am I right?
Yes, that was a remarkable story. This shows you how far back this white supremacy movement goes. They were planning at that time to keep blacks from voting in a referendum in which North Carolina, after the war, was required to create a new constitution. And as part of this, freed slaves were for the first time given the right to vote. So the Ku Klux Klan said, we have got to keep these blacks from voting because they're going to outvote us. So they started this terror campaign in Wilmington to keep blacks from voting. Abraham Galloway, escaped slave, he was a Union spy. He was elected as a state senator during the next year's election. He organized an informal militia of blacks who didn't have guns, but they had fence posts and sticks and clubs. They confronted the KKK on the streets of Wilmington in 1868 and drove them out of the city. The Klan did not reappear in Wilmington until the 1920s, but they were replaced by the Red Shirts, was an outgrowth of the
Klan. So the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, we have successful efforts to fight white supremacy led by African-American leaders. Successful efforts to fight white supremacy on the streets and at the polls, as we saw in the elections in Wilmington. So that those successes, there it was still in tension up until then, and now it becomes institutionalized after 1898. And everybody, including later on the Nazis, would use this as a template for their own program of white supremacy.
Exactly. What the coup did was allow white supremacy to be officially instated as state policy, not just in Wilmington, but across the state, probably for the next 60 or 70 years. When the leaders of the coup, who, by the way, put themselves in power, they, quote, elected themselves and they took over, when they drove out the three black city aldermen in 1898. There was not another black city alderman until 1972. They also harassed and intimidated George Henry White, who was a congressman from North Carolina and was the absolute single only black member of Congress at the time. They harassed him and his family, and he fled the state. After he left office, there was not another black citizen elected to Congress from North Carolina until 1992, almost a century later. And that wasn't that long ago.
And voter suppression efforts continue even today. David Zucchino, contributing writer for The New York Times, author of Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. David kicks off his North Carolina book tour at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on January 14th. He stops in Wilmington, Raleigh, Greensboro, and Asheville, and you can check our website for all the dates. David, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Frank.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things, produced by Anita Rao, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Moorman, and Josie Torres. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.